On this episode of The Flatus Show, number 44, government. I'm going to talk about anarchism, communism, capitalism, and a bunch of other stuff, other forms of government. I'll talk about how to make a matzo chocolate refrigerator cake. And I also read a letter from podcaster Randy he wrote in response to my last episode. And then there's a big C segment. This and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Okay, you hear the soda here? Well, I was recording this, and I popped the cork, and it wasn't recording, so you'll have to just assume for a minute. You're just going to have to think about the sound it makes. It is Diet Moxie for my diet, with gentian root causing the bitter flavor in it. And it's also used, gentian root is used in Egg Nostra bitters. It's good for your digestive system, apparently. Jose was up here sniffing around. I also have matzah, which you'll find out later about the matzah. Mmm, it's crispy. Welcome to the Flatus Show. I'm Kenty. Jose's in the room today. He's wide awake. Unbelievable. You can reach us at kenty@theflatusshow.com. You can visit my website, www.theflatusshow.com. You can reach me by phone at 206-339-JOSE. Right, Jose? Mm-hmm. You gonna do some more sniffing? Sniff. You hear him? Okay, so I got some matzah meeting. This is going to be a long show, so this opening is going to be short. But I want to welcome new listener, Kara. Hi, Kara. How you doing? I know Kara. I've known Kara. I know Kara for many, many years. But she's new to the show. What else? Okay. I'm just going to start the show. This opening is very short. I don't know what to say, but the show is going to be interesting. And you'll see. There's a letter from Randy, podcaster Randy, I read. There's a big segment on Big C. And then the rest is about all sorts of things. Anarchism, the matzo ball, no refrigerator cake. Not matzo ball. Matzo, no refrigerator cake. That would be matzo refrigerator cake. It's actually chocolate cake. A chocolate refrigerator cake using matzo. So, on with the show. A few weeks ago, Big C sent me the following voice comment.
Hey, Ken, this is Big C. I got another first for you. I thought you and I could probably do a duet over the internet, of course. What I'm thinking is you can pick a song, play it on your ukulele, and sing it, and either have me a part or just say, you know, sing along with me or whatever. Anyway, send it to me in my email. And if you put down the tabs, or the chords, rather, I can play my guitar and sing along with you. Or I can just sing along with you, whatever. But anyway, I thought it'd be pretty cool, and I'll send it back to you, and you can play it on your show. Just let me know. You get my email. Bye.
So after some consideration of a song that we could sing as a duet, and taking some time to arrange it for a duet, we decided to do it. So here is the result. This is the Rainbow Connection, and Big C and I are going to perform this across many miles. You ready, Big C?
I'm ready, Kinty.
Why are there so many
songs about rainbows?
And what's on the other side?
Rainbows are visions,
but only illusions.
And rainbows have nothing to hide.
So we've been told, and some choose to believe it.
I know the wrong way to see.
Someday we'll find it,
a rainbow connection. Lovers,
the dreamers, and me.
Who said that every wish
will be heard and answered,
and wished on a morning star?
Somebody thought of that,
and someone believed him.
Look what it's done so far.
What's so amazing
and keeps us stargazing?
What do you think we might see?
Someday we'll find it,
the rainbow connection. The lovers,
the dreamers, and me. Have you been half asleep?
Have you heard voices?
I've heard them calling my name.
Are these the sweet sounds?
Called the young sailors.
I think they're one and the same.
I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something I'm supposed to be.
Someday we'll find it,
the rainbow connection. The lovers,
the dreamers,
and me.
Someday we'll find it,
the rainbow connection. The lovers,
the dreamers,
and me.
And you too, Big C.
Thanks, Ken.
Big C and I also are working on another project. We're going to see if we can get together and do a podcast together, tentatively called What I Believe. And we did a little test, and I'm going to play that test for you so you get an idea of what we're going to talk about.
What I Believe. Join me, Big C, and listener Ken, as we start up a new podcasting adventure called What I Believe. Sometimes we'll hear ideas such as this.
It really just infuriates me, because what it is that these people, you know, whatever they're doing, they take the conversation and they make it seem like all gays hate Christians, which
right.
is wrong. You know, it's like, and they have these black and white scenarios, and it's not black and white.
Sometimes you'll find that we don't see eye to eye.
And he was overclassifying, but I felt this pain. I wanted to be a little bit of devil's advocate, and that's why I was like, hey, let's start our own show. And you get these so-called, quote-unquote, leaders on television throwing out racial slurs against white people that I could never say. And Louis Farrakhan goes to mind. And I get mad because
of course
he classifies all whites as evil.
You will always find an open place for discussion where you can bring new ideas and hear new points of view on ideas that you thought you had a lock on.
It should be an argument of ideas, not personal. Not personal things, you know?
What I Believe. Come join our open discussion weekly as we bring you What I Believe. Coming soon.
Che a Dio spiegasti l'ori, o bell'alma innamorata, ti rivolgi a me placata, ecco ascenda il tuo fedele.
This is the letter, email I received from Randy, podcaster Randy, regarding the last show 43. Hey, Ken, I seriously love what you do with your show. I listened to your commentary on the feud between Madge and Curry, and I was really affected by your personal story. Kids can be cruel, and those very real and hurtful times can cause almost anyone to act in ways they wouldn't ordinarily act. Fortunately, you had a moment of clarity and avoided disaster. What a terrific and personal example, Ken. I can't say enough about how powerful that was. Very cool of you to share it and maybe help someone out. I don't know if you listened to Kerry's rebuttal or not. I have to say, I could see his point on many things. He doesn't impress me as a bigot, and I can tell you from experiences at work that being called one or having your integrity called into question can really piss you off if you know in your own heart that your intention was not to offend. Sometimes it seems like a cheap shot to throw the hater card out there. In Curry's case, he seems to have had a good relationship with Madge, and he was probably surprised, as was I, with the venom she showed him, even if he was wrong. I don't think I used the word fag in my normal speech, but I know I have made jokes with Andy, that's his co-host on his show, Two Guys, One Brain, about things being gay. In fact, I said it on the show recently. I said, that's gay. And then I thought of you and added, in the bad way. I actually meant to say something to you about it, but I forgot. I guess as heterosexual males, the word gay has some duality of meaning to us. If I say, that's gay, we both understand it to mean lame or unfair or chicken shit. So do I. For example, I showed that trooper my badge and he still wrote me a ticket for 5 miles per hour over the speed limit. That's just gay. I don't think in my mind that a homosexual person, and I would be referring to the situation, not the trooper. I don't think in my mind about a homosexual person, and I would be referring to the situation, not the trooper. Sorry about that. And above all, I would not be trying to offend anyone. But then I think about it, and why wouldn't a gay person find that comparison at least a little offensive? Thank you, Randy, because you know what? That's one of the nicest things that you could write, because that's true. I understand what you mean by, you know, that's gay. I do. But at the same time, you're referring to part of me. So, yeah, right. Why wouldn't I be a little offended? To use it in a bad way. I like that. The good way, the bad way. Anyway, I find it interesting that when I said it and I knew you were going to hear it, it made me uncomfortable, and I tried to explain myself by saying it was gay in the bad way, not in an actual homosexual way, which I'd like to say is the good way. I'm itching my leg, and I'm going to finish reading this email. I think fag is much different, though. It speaks specifically to a person and is unquestionably derogative based on its usage in our culture. When I was in grade school, it was the worst name you could be called, and I'm not even sure we knew what it meant exactly. The same for me, because we're contemporaries in age. And yeah, being called a fag is the worst thing. But for someone who is a fag, it's doubly worse because at that time, you're not really out. No kid is really out. I mean, unless they're a big flaming queen, and then they can't help but being out and get beat up and be called a fag. But for for the majority of homosexuals, they're just, gay people are just like you or me. So you're in a group of friends and you hear fag and you're like, I hope they don't know I'm a fag. So anyway. Okay. Curry defends his use, or more accurately, his tolerance of the use of the word by reminding us that several Q Potters have used the word fag when referring to themselves in correspondence with him. And while I see his point, I don't think any person of whiteness would use the N-word at a rap concert just because the brothers were doing it. I have a black friend who takes great pleasure in my discomfort when he tries to get me to say the N-word. I consider you a friend of mine, Ken, and I would hate it if I used a word inadvertently that offended you. I think when it happens, as it did with Curry and Madge, it's not because the middle-aged homosexual white guys are purposefully minimizing the struggles of a particular ethnicity or orientation. I think it's because some of us are naive enough to think that in this day and age, those struggles are in the past. I think you're absolutely right about that. People think that the struggle is gone, and it's not. I don't listen to your show just because you are gay, nor do I listen to it in spite of the fact that you're gay. I listen to it because it almost always makes me think about things I would never think about otherwise. You said it was time to stop tolerating these things and fight to make a difference. Well, thank you. He goes on, I think you already are my friend. Be proud of your show, Randy. Well, thank you, Randy. It's a very nice email. One of the nicest emails I've ever received regarding my show. And as I responded to you, I consider you a friend. I don't think you'd say anything nasty. And if you did say something, I think I would have the balls to let you know. But I don't want anybody to be PC on my account, because I think PC is really a bad thing. You know, I don't know what I'm saying. Just watch it when you're talking around kids. That's really the thing. We're adults, you know? Words are words, and that's fine. And we should all be under the same understanding that they're just words. But what bothers me is kids who are listening, because that oppresses the homosexual child, as I know from personal experience, and as other homosexual, gay people know, that as a child, it is oppressive. Because there is no visibility. Maybe it's different now. I don't know what it's like to grow up as a gay child today. But when I was a child, and Randy, you were the same age as I am. And Adam Curry is the same age as I am. So, we're all in the same boat. There was no, like I said, my thing, I knew about gay people because, there was the village people and they talked about San Francisco is full of fairies and, Greenwich Village was full of fairies. So there were two people, but San Francisco is the one that stuck out in my mind. That's why I wanted to go to California, figuring it was much more liberal and open and accepting. So, but how wrong I am or was. But thank you, Randy, so much.
Of Afghanistan, there's a Hindu maiden, a man. She swore by the stars up above her that he was the one to love her. But there came another one day, stole his Hindu maiden away. Hindu man is lonely and blue. In his dreams, he's calling to her. Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the fair oasis waiting for you, and for you only. Cross the desert sand, we will find a temple. There will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan. Wealth of Afghanistan cannot ease the heart of this man. Though the stars with splendor are shining, Hindu's heart can't stop its pining. Though he's trying hard to forget, he has hopes and dreams of her yet. Thinking that she'll come back someday, to his idol he keeps praying. Afghanistan, there's a caravan by the fair oasis waiting for you, and for you only. Cross the desert sand, we will find a temple. There will be a bridal day for you, my idol, in Afghanistan.
Anarchy. And other forms of government. Okay, I'm going to read this section and then make comments. Hold on. Okay. Anarchism. Okay, we're going to start with anarchism because it's going to touch on other things too. This is from Wikipedia, wikipedia.org, the free encyclopedia online for all your information needs. Anarchism is derived from the Greek, and it's in Greek, and I don't know how to read Greek, without archons, ruler, chief, king. So it's without a chief. Thus, anarchism, in its most general meaning, is the belief that social coercion and competition is an unnecessary evil and should be abolished. Anarchism also refers to related social movements that advocate the elimination of coercive institutions. The word anarchy, as most anarchists use it, does not imply chaos, nihilism, or anomie. I don't know what that means. But rather a harmonious anti-authoritarian society that is based on individual self-determination and personal involvement. In place of what are regarded as authoritarian political structures and coercive economic institutions, Walmart, anarchists advocate social relations based upon voluntary association of free individuals in autonomous communities, mutual aid, and self-governance. The word anarchist originated as a term of abuse at the Putney Debates, 1647, during the English Civil War. Thomas Rainsborough remarked, "I know that some particular men we debate with believe we are for anarchy." After Oliver Cromwell had said, "No man says that you have a mind to anarchy, but that the consequence of this rule tends to anarchy, must end in anarchy." The term was later used against working-class radicals and sans-culottes, whatever that means, it's a French word, during and following the French Revolution. Anarchist! Whilst the term is still used in a pejorative way to describe any act that used violent means to destroy the organization of society, Bolshevik... yeah. Let me stop here. Little Orphan Annie, in her early days, fought Bolshevism. There were bombs being, Bolsheviks trying to destroy capitalism. They're anarchists. And, of course, Little Orphan Annie was there to help, her and Sandy. Arf! Arf! It has also been taken up as a positive label for self-defined anarchist. While anarchism is most easily defined by what it is against, anarchists offer positive visions of what they believe to be a truly free society. It sort of reminds me of libertarianism. However, ideas about how an anarchist society might work vary considerably, especially with respect to economics. There is also disagreement about how a free society might be brought about. Scholars generally do not consider there to be one monolithic anarchism. Beyond the anti-statist commonality that justifies a wide variety of philosophies as all being forms of anarchism, specific forms of anarchism may overlap in additional respects with other forms, and yada, 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 yada. So, I mean, it's like any idea. There's no pure capitalism. There's no pure communism. There's nothing. There's an idea. The idea is without a ruler. And what the human challenge is to see how a society like that would work. Now I'm going to pause here because I want to go get my tea. Back with my tea because my throat is very dry. Okay. So, there's these ideas of anarchism, so I was thinking about this. It was Kurt Vonnegut said something about secular humanism. The definition of secular humanism is a person who does the right thing because he knows it is the right thing to do, and he doesn't do it because someone told him that it's the right thing to do. And that's what I believe. I think ultimately, if you leave people alone... I shouldn't say leave people alone. I just don't think it's necessary to I think people know what the right thing to do is. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe they need to learn it. But at the same time, as I mentioned, I'm rude, but this is podcasting. So anyway, as I was saying, it's like I know kids who were raised in these religious environments with strict rules, and you know what? They ended up being bad. So what point is it if the people can't follow the rules in the religion? Maybe just some people are stupid, you know, and bad. I don't know. I don't know what causes it. What do you think causes stupid people to do stupid things? That's the only problem with anarchism, is stupidity. Now, in, what was it, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there was a joke, is that they sent, they said there was a society, and they told certain parts of society, the unimportant people like beauticians and producers and people who really, middlemen who didn't really do anything, they said that, well, the planet's going to blow up, so why don't you go on this ship and fly off the planet and, you know, we'll follow after. Of course, they didn't follow after, but they sent this group of middle people, the beauticians and everything, off, and they actually ended up on Earth and millions of years ago, and that's where we evolved from, as this group of stupid people. I don't know. Have you ever seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or read the books? They're so funny. They're so good. Okay, so back to anarchism. Let's see here. Oh, there's all sorts. Okay, as the different types of anarchism, there is, there's anarcho-feminism. There's anarchist communism, which you would expect, right? Bolshevism. Christian anarchist, which I, you know, that was really interesting. Green anarchism, which I don't know what that is. And anarcho-capitalism. Okay, let's talk about capitalism and communism. I was reading the Communist Manifesto last year because I wanted to, you know, what is this really all about anyway? I mean, I read the Marx, read some Marx in college for the intellectual heritage course I talked about. We had to read about all these different ideas, and let's face it, I mean, it's an important idea, you know, affected a lot of people in the West, all over the world, even China. Modern thought. So, I'm reading the Communist Manifesto. It, you know, when I was a kid, you know, communism was like, okay, everybody had a house, and no one had to worry, and it was all free, and no one starved, and, you know, I don't know why I thought that. I really don't. Maybe I just figured, well, communism, everybody has a house. You know, you don't have to worry about that. And I just thought that was, you know, the cat's meow, I guess. And so I remember the first time I went to Temple. Now, I grew up in the suburbs, right? The first time I went to, and this is all an idea, communism, right? So I went to college. It was at Temple University. And the first day of school, they have everybody and their mother, Scientologists, communists, Jews for Jesus. They were all out there on their tables hawking and trying to, like, get you to sign up for their club. And I remember the communists walking by them, and this girl, she has this, like, red signal, "Communism, take over the world! Take over the world! The worker! I was like, Jesus Christ, it scared the hell out of me. I was like a new wave kind of guy at that point. It was the early 80s, 1983. But I was like, this is communism? Oh, my God. And the Jews for Jesus bothered me, too. I'm like, what the hell are they doing? What the hell are they talking about? So anyway, where was I going with this? Let's see here. The communist. Okay, so I was reading the Communist Manifesto. It's really all about work. Giving the worker work. That's it. It doesn't really say anything about art. And as we know from, like, Russian, you know, it was, what were the guarantees? That you had a house? Look what it got you. You know, communist daycare center made out of concrete. And that was it. That was the guarantee. You know, work, production. Where capitalism, if you think about it, is, you know, you do and you earn on your own, right? Which is fine for me because, you know what, if I could do exactly what I love to do and make money at it, that's the ideal. And that's like what I think capitalism is. But today, in this country, it's just big business, which is really just a substitute for a communist government. Look at Walmart. Walmart, if you just were to take Walmart, cut it out of the United States landscape, it's communism. You know, the way that these big corporations run, it's like a communism. That's, I swear to God, maybe my grandfather is prophetic. He talked about this every Sunday morning. Be careful of the Chinese. There are a billion Chinese that are going to take over the world. And maybe they are going to take over the world. I mean, look what's been happening with the trade in the United States. I mean, this trade deficit, and we're taking all these loans from China. And you go to Walmart or you go to any of these stores, Target, everything is made in China. Everything. My ukulele was made in China. I bet you half the things here are made in China. More than half, except the house. The house is made here. So where is this going to? You know, what is going on here? Another thing also is they're talking about global warming and global dimming. And also I'm going to talk about food. This is all things I've been thinking about lately and I've been talking to other people about. Okay. Global dimming is apparently cooling down the planet, right? So you have global warming, which is heating up the planet and melting the ice caps. Then you have something called global dimming caused from pollution. The United States is not producing as much pollution as other parts. Now, because China and India are, you know, there is a lot of pollution coming out of China and I think India, they said. This is causing global dimming, sort of keeping things in stasis. It's also fucking up weather patterns so that there's these droughts in Ethiopia and stuff like that, which normally wouldn't have happened. So, okay. I'm thinking there's a policy in the United States to have China continue to do what they're doing, to produce smog for global dimming, to keep the world in stasis. Okay? Okay. Put more crap into the air, China. you don't have to have any kind of emissions, you know, problems. Because if the air started to actually clear up, the Earth would heat up, and it would be a lot sooner that we would have flooding and everything. And there goes the North Pole. It's not a pole anymore. It's just a water polo, the North Polo, water polo. So anyway, so that's like, you know, what's going on with China and India and the smog and global warming. You know, you read all these horror stories, but what is it all about? Is it real or is it just an idea to keep you in your place, to worry about your future? Because, you know, it might not happen now, but actually they're saying it could happen within our lifetime, but certainly our children's lifetimes. Why would anybody want to bring a new life into this planet with what is going on? Now, I mean, this is not to make anybody with children feel bad, but, you know, I don't know how people can do themselves. It's like sending your child to doom, that we continue to live the way we do in this world. I don't know where it's going, you know? I mean, and maybe that's a pessimistic view. Okay, a second thing is talking to our favorite lady at the plant center here in Cape Ann. Goose Cove. And if I can remember the name of it, I'll say. But anyway, we were talking about food, and she was saying that, really, we should only be eating food that's within 40 miles of where we live. So, you know, in the winter, you can do without, you know, strawberries and pears. Now, what's happening is these seed companies are going to like Africa and stuff, and having people grow things like strawberries in the winter to import to the United States, so you know Mary Sue can have her strawberry shortcake, and she's fat enough anyway. Mary Sue, she probably is going to die soon anyway from all the fat in her body with the strawberry shortcake. But anyway, I'm no better because I'm overweight. I keep on thinking I'm going to have a heart attack any minute. I think that's anxiety, though. I have to stop drinking caffeine because the Boost bar is working so nicely, but I still have these thoughts of dropping dead. So anyway, Mary Sue wants her strawberries and there's a market for it. So what it does, these seed companies go, hey, you know, little farmer here, we'll grow strawberries for us. We'll give you some money. Well, what happens is that, yeah, they give them the seeds. The seeds are Terminator seeds, which they can't, like, harvest the seeds again. So they have to keep on buying the seeds. Plus, the plot of land that these people were growing the strawberries on was the plot of land which fed the village. So what you have is they're making less money growing strawberries for Fat Mary in wherever for her strawberry shortcake.
Oh, this is so good. Ooh, another strawberry shortcake in the middle of winter. Oh, how do they ever do this? Let me get into my SUV and put some emissions into the air. Oh, methane.
Yeah. Fat Mary is, you know, causing all this. But we should, you know, we should not be eating this crap. You know, don't have pears in the winter. I don't know. What the hell am I saying? Find out what you're eating. That's what I want you to do, okay? All I'm doing is be mindful. There's supposed to be a movie called What You Eat or something. It's a DVD. You know, I'm going to have to... Okay, I'm at 16 minutes here. I'm going to find out and I'll do my... The food movie. And I'll do my little Godzilla thing. I'll find out. I'll give you the name of it. But anyway... The DVD is called The Future of Food. What is going on with the world? You know? It's terrible. I feel guilty about everything I do. And it's not just living. It's like every step you take, you hear about these horrible things. It's like, you know, buying... I never buy strawberries in the winter, so I do not do that. Another thing is if you go into the supermarket... Okay, there was on Terry Gross... on Fresh Air. She was talking about how corn is destroying America. Corn is subsidized. The government subsidizes corn production. Now, what corn production does, what does it do? First of all, it has made corn so cheap. Or what is this? It's actually, if it were without the economics of corn being subsidized, right, farmers wouldn't be growing corn because it takes more money to grow corn than what it's actually worth. Okay, corn, this produces a lot of, they use corn to produce like corn syrup and stuff. Corn syrup is in everything, all junk food, even in like tortillas, Doritos and stuff. Now, this is causing the obesity in America. It's causing all these problems like diabetes. I really think that the government knows about this and is trying to kill off the people. The United States. I swear to God, I hate to say that. It really sounds awful. But come on, get with the program, you know? It should be more affordable to eat correctly. And we shouldn't have to, Americans shouldn't have to bother with this kind of crap, you know? They should be outlawed, places like McDonald's. Then you're going to say, capitalism, capitalism. Well, you know what? It's beyond capitalism at this point. It's a health issue. And like I said, these big companies are just like giant communist countries anyway, you know? We should be doing more on our own, you know? There should be smaller, should be more mom-and-pop stores. There should be smaller industries. You know, these big companies, you know? Suppose all these big companies decide to leave America and go somewhere else. We would be, you know, boned, basically. So there has to be a reason why they're staying here, right? So, we'll see. Who knows? Who knows?
Quando salì della Habana, valgame Dio.
performative. This past week, I went on a search for Reagan Fox's dissertation, which earned him the doctorate degree, because he's been talking about it. Now, Reagan Fox, he is host of a show called, what's it called? Fox and the City, or Fox in the City? It can be either. I think it should be Fox in the City, because it's sort of like Fox in the Hen House. Because he pushes the envelope, so he's like a fox in the hen house. But anyway, he's also a co-host from other shows. Eat Bird of one, and his co-host is Rachel Cann. And then the other show is Eat This Hot Show with co-hosts Wanda Wisdom and Madge Weinstein. But we're talking about Reagan Fox, and so I found it. I won't tell you how I found it. And there's these words in there, it's like, that are not normally used in everyday speech. And so, I had to, get out my dictionary and find out what performative is and reevocation. And I'm not really sure I understand his meaning of the word with what I found for definition. So I'm wondering if it is a jargon used in a particular philosophical, line of thinking. Like, is this critical thinking, or what's that other thing? Like new wave thinking, or what's that French thing with Foucault? Constructionism and deconstructionism and postmodern. And I sort of got that idea of what he was talking about when he was talking about performance, the performance of the person. I always think of performance as an artificial, or something artificial. But I guess, everybody performs. I guess that's what's the right word here? What am I thinking of? Just unqualitative definition, performance. So performative. So anyway, I read here performative is actually a term. It's from Wikipedia, wikipedia.org, for all your information needs. It's a free encyclopedia online. An utterance is a performative when its function is to perform the action mentioned rather than to express a proposition about, as a constative does. The term was introduced by J.L. Austin in his paper Other Minds and developed in later works, especially in his 1955 William James Lectures, published in How to Do Things with Words. He found great difficulty in drawing a completely clear distinction between performatives and constatives, and eventually abandoned it in favor of a much more complex set of distinctions. So, who uses this language? I mean, I guess, people who are studying whatever, I don't know. What do you think about this language? Isn't there another way to talk about these things without creating words? It just makes things more difficult, I think. Why do you need a new word to describe something? Unless it is something new, right? I guess that's what it is. I don't know. Anyway, I was going to talk more about this. Reevocation. I just love these words. And then I looked up some performance art things. And performance art is like one of those things which I find is like a blowjob, sort of. I saw an installation once in New York. It was called 10,000 Miles or something like that. And what it was the gallery. It was the only thing in the gallery. And you go into the gallery, and on the floor are these 12-inch long metal pieces of metal, solid metal. I think it was not copper. It was stainless steel, I think. And they were all lined up like 4 inches apart from each other in like four or five rows, and there was like 10,000 feet of metal, but it was all broken up. And I asked my friend Marnie. That was with an I, E. And she tried to explain it to me because she was studying Foucault and all this stuff, and she was really into it. But I was like, I just don't get it. Like, why would anybody pay to see this? It was actually free to go see this. It was at the gallery, but who would buy it? Another thing, we were both at the Museum of Modern Art, and we're walking through. Now, I love modern art, and I love, you know, like de Kooning and stuff. I guess I need to have something to go on. I don't like this idea stuff. So we were in there, and we're walking, and there's this black splotch on the wall. It was attached to the wall. It was like somebody cut out an oval pill shape of out of black cardboard and stuck it to the wall, and underneath it says, "Black Blip, number 400 by whoever, blowjob." What is the idea? She tried to tell me, like, well, this is one of 400 black blips, so this black blip is somewhere else. I think it was also around this time that there was a performance artist who spray painted a banana on the sidewalks. Because in New York at the time, everywhere you looked, there was a spray painting of a banana. So I don't get that. I guess I'm more traditional. More traditional modern, I guess, because I think you need to have paint and canvas. But I guess you don't, you know? I guess you can, you know, philosophize your way out of the canvas and out of the painting. In fact, there was an article in the Art News or one of those magazines. Actually, I didn't read the article. I just saw the cover. It was like the cover. And it said something about what is happening to oil painting. Basically, you know, people were saying this is an oil painting and there's like no oil. There's no paint on the thing. So I don't know how they get away with that. I'm an oil painter. I'm an oil painter and I do portraits. Then, ma'am, why are you showing me this photograph of a landscape? Because the people are on the outside of the frame and the oil is in the oil of life. Because oil and water don't mix. And it's like a communist and a capitalist together. So anyway, I don't understand it. Okay, so I want to talk about a matzo ball cake. Not matzo ball, a matzo cake. It's a no-bake matzo cake. The reason why is that Passover is over and you can get matzo for like next to nothing. I got 5 boxes of matzo for $2.85. Now, I'm 1/8 Jewish actually, but I love matzo. It has no flavor, really. It's just crunchy. It's good with butter and it's also good if you crack it up and put it with egg and, like, fry it up. It's good. So anyway, here is a no-bake, no-fail yummy matzo cake I found on the internet. You need 6 ounces of butter, 6 ounces of sugar, 2 eggs separated, 1 ounce of cocoa, a pinch of salt, 6 matzo, approximately 1/4 pint of wine, grated chocolate and blanched almonds. Cream together the margarine, or the butter, and the sugar. You could use margarine, I guess, until very soft. Beat in the egg yolks and sifted cocoa. Beat the egg whites and salt until very stiff, and fold into the mixture. So you're going to have 2 bowls here. You're going to beat the sugar and the butter together. Add your egg yolks and the cocoa. That's bowl 1. In a separate bowl, beat your egg whites until very stiff. And to make sure it's clean, make sure the beaters are clean. Because if you have any kind of oil, the egg whites will not become egg white, like that meringue. You're going to fold the meringue mixture into the egg yolks mixture, the chocolate mixture. What you do is you place 1 matzo on a sheet of foil, moisten well with wine, and spread with the chocolate mixture. Repeat the process until all the matzo are used up, ending with a layer of cream. Spread the rest of the cream around the sides. Decorate with grated chocolate and blanched almonds. Chill in the refrigerator and remove a 30 minutes before serving. There's another one here, too, which I like better, actually. It's a no-bake matzo refrigerator cake. You need cognac, 5 matzos, 6 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate, 1/4 cup of water, 1/4 cup of sugar, 4 egg yolks, 1 stick of butter, 2 ounces of chipped almonds or other chipped nuts. Okay, what you're going to do is put your matzo on a plate or foil. You're going to put it down and wet the matzo with the cognac on each side. Dip it in just a little bit because it will soak up. It soaks up a lot of liquid. It will soak up a lot of liquid. So don't have it on there too long because one matzo will probably like suck up half a bottle of cognac. So put those aside. Put that down. Okay. You know what? I want to redo this. You're going to get your chocolate done first, okay? So don't worry about the matzo right now. On the top of a double boiler, melt the chocolate, water, sugar, and some liquor, like a shot of a cognac. And stir that until it's smooth, okay? Beat in the egg yolks one at a time. Turn on the heat and cook over boiling water for 3 minutes, stirring constantly. Cool to lukewarm and beat in the butter bit by bit. So you have a whole stick of butter. So you're going to cut that into teaspoons and drop it in one at a time. Beat it until it's nice and until it's incorporated. Talk about, you know, heart stopping. But, you know, you're not going to eat the whole cake. So now what you're going to do, you take your matzah, wet it with the cognac. You can also use sherry. And then you're going to put some of the chocolate mixture on the top of the matzah, okay? Sprinkle that with nuts, and then put another matzah, which has been soaked with cognac or sherry, on top of that. Frost that with this chocolate, add some nuts until you're finished. You should have 5 matzahs. And then you take the rest of the chocolate and cover the whole thing, so it will look like a cake, like a square cake. Then you stick it in the refrigerator until it has, you know, hardened, it says here, about 4 hours. So I'm going to try it. Let me know what my listeners think about this recipe. It sounds like it'll be fun.
You've been listening to The Flavor Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at Kenty@theflatishow.com.